Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live and freshly vacationed from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 172 of Registry Matters. Larry, here we are again. Took a week off. How you been?
Fantastic.
Did you do anything exciting? Did you gallivant across the globe?
I did not.
Oh, well, all right then. Well, I did some gallivanting and it was a good time and I'm glad that I had the week off. I didn't have to worry about talking to you people so much. So there's that.
Yeah, that was really, really great for me too. It was respite.
Before we move on, make sure that you press the like and subscribe and write reviews and go to all those places and do that stuff on your podcast app of choice and all those things. That would help out the show a lot if you would do those things. Larry, tell me what we have on the program for this evening before we get going.
Well, time permitting, we're going to have a few current events. We're going to talk about the denial of a cert petition filed in a case that NARSL was participating in, May versus Ryan from the Ninth Circuit. We've got some listener submissions. And in fact, we received a plea from a prisoner who's read the NARSL Digest newsletter, and I think one of our transcripts, and he's finding the Interstate Compact to be very troubling and consternating for him. So he wrote a long question, and I condensed it as best I could, and we'll get to that question later in the program. But I had to summarize it because we'd be here for way too long reading this submission in its entirety. Okay. And we have an audio clip from our super patron as well.
That is awesome. I also, he did his registration stuff this week, and we'll get to that. But he gave me a little bit of like a transcript of what he did, and it was, it's quite entertaining what happened with him at the registration office. So we'll get to that. And I was going to like actually turn this into like, put audio clips behind it and turn it into this big theatrical thing, but I didn't have time to get through all that. But I'll do my best to portray it out and tell the story, narrate the incident as it occurred. All right, then. Well, I guess we'll get going with what happens up first, right?
Let's do it.
All right. Well, I think Will posted a question over at Patreon, and it says, is it just me, or should judges, who are lawyers in most cases, be smart enough and knowledgeable enough to actually know and understand the nature of the AWA? Adam Walsh Act. What does it say when our judges and justices don't even understand the law? If they can't, don't, won't understand it correctly, how can they fairly expect anyone else to? Is that not part of the design? Make it so confusing and vague that people of ordinary intelligence cannot navigate it correctly without running afoul of some little technical gotcha? I think that's a kind of a fair question, but I'm pretty sure your answer is going to be that the body of law is just so freaking huge. How could anybody actually have a clue of everything? You can't be an expert on everything, unless your name is Larry. Larry, you're an expert on everything.
Right. Well, the last part of it about having a person of ordinary intelligence, the laws are supposed to be written with sufficient clarity that a person of ordinary intelligence can understand what is required of them, and it's supposed to be written in such a way, succinctly enough, that there won't be arbitrary and capricious enforcement by law enforcement. But he jumped off on the Adam Walsh Act. So first of all, that's federal law, and it's only recommendations to states. So it really seldom comes into play in terms of your registration obligations in a particular state. They may have decided to adopt parts or substantial amount of the Adam Walsh recommendations, or virtually none. Vermont has adopted virtually none. But in terms of whether a judge should understand all that stuff, you're right. The body of law, not case law, is so large that that's why we have adversarial system there. It's your attorney's duty to understand the law that you're going to be subjected to based on your conviction. And in the United States Supreme Court case of PDF versus Kentucky many years ago, the Supreme Court made that clear, that all the known consequences of your plea are supposed to be explained to you by the lawyer. Now, not future consequences that have not been determined yet, they're not required to be clairvoyant and anticipate any changes in regulations that might apply to you, but they're supposed to disclose those. Not the judge's duty per se, but in some states, actually, they do require that. The laws have been evolving to where courts are required to explain all these things and make sure the person understands on the record. But no, the judge wouldn't understand the Animal Shack. That's an unreasonable expectation.
Is it sort of like your attorney's job is to then, I don't want to say dumb it down, I don't mean it that way, but to compact all of the stuff, providing the judge with references to other case law that they can then go reference, like here's case number such and such, maybe it's from this state, another state, but give them the cheater notes almost of how you're presenting your case and why it should go your way?
Yes, but in the case of this, I think Will's focusing on registration, I'm guessing, because he mentioned Adam Walsh Act, which has to do with registration. Like, for example, you might have a state that has multi-registration obligations, and depending on what offense you're convicted of, the judge is not going to know all that. They're not going to know all 38, 42 offenses are on the registry and what triggers a particular type of registration obligation. That's your attorney's job to tell you that. If you plead to this offense, this is what's going to be required. Now, the truth of the matter is attorneys don't always know. In our state, I'm constantly advising attorneys, you've got it wrong. They won't be subject to that. They'll be subject to this. Okay. But that's the attorney's job to do that. The judge may have to apprise you of it. And the judge may ask the two attorneys, you know, the state's attorney and the defense attorney, do we agree that this is a 10-year registration obligation? But the judge is not going to know other than what the judge is told. If the parties agree, the judge is going, yep, it's a 10-year registration obligation, and everyone may be wrong.
And while I get Will's point about them, they're lawyers most of the time, then they're just there to make sure that there's order, that people follow a protocol, that it's something close to fair. I mean, they're referees, so to speak. They're not necessarily supposed to. I mean, could you throw just an average intelligence person up there to be a judge and give them some sort of playbook? Then the prosecution and defense go at it, and they just make sure that there's order kept. I know that there's a ruling in the end by the judge, but I'm not trying to diminish their purpose. I'm trying to sort of explain away their necessity to know everything, so to speak.
Well, the judge would ultimately decide the law if the parties disagree. The judge would ultimately. So being a lawyer would be helpful for the judge, because the judge may have to retire to chambers and say, I'm going to look at the law because the parties don't agree, and the judge may rule. But really good judges try to get the parties to agree, you know, that this is what the law says.
And I'm trying to think back to me attending the case with the Butts County thing with the signs in the yards. And both sides pulling out guns blazing, saying that this is this rule, or this is this rule, or this is undecided, this is new information. Talking specifically in that case about the easement stuff, that's right. Unsettled of where that would fall. Just trying to point, like, we don't know the answer to this. So then the judge has to decide which way that goes based on what we don't know.
Or the judge says we have a trial and we find out.
Right. All right. Well, then I guess we shall move on to the next thing. And this is from a longtime patron. His name's Mike, and he's in Jersey. And he says, I got a question for you, Larry. When I used to drive I-355 in Illinois, was a private toll road, and I think it still is. I believe there was a court decision saying that since it is considered infrastructure, that they could not discriminate who can use it. Could the same apply to Facebook, Twitter, etc.? Since they are so large, they should be considered media. Could they legally block PFRs and even Donald Trump? That's for you, Larry, from using it. Or would this be a good way to fight it? At the very least, a way the PFRs are not convicted of internet-related crimes to at least be allowed to use the internet where they are not allowed. I like that question a lot. I think that's kind of a neat way to frame it, going against a private toll road versus these the social media companies, the big social media companies.
Well, I don't know the particulars, but toll roads, I don't really know that are truly private. I mean, they operate on government right of way, and they need to be open to everyone. Again, Facebook and Twitter, these are all privately owned, and it's interesting and humorous to watch the flip-flop that the conservatives have done on this. For all the years since media deregulation and being told that we do not need to try to have government imposing on broadcasters what they should carry and how they should set up their programming, the market will take care of it, and the market will respond and correct. That's what we've been told since the late 70s and early 80s when the massive deregulation of media was done. You know, when they abolished the fairness doctrine and equal time and all those different things that the big old bad government required, the same people that said, you don't need to worry about that, they have amazingly flipped now. And they're saying that Facebook and Twitter are too large, and we need you to use the powers of government to come in and force them to carry. But see, it's interesting because the voices are being silenced are now conservatives. It used to be the liberals that were complaining about their voices being silenced by the large conglomerate broadcasters that carried Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and Michael Levin and all these people that are from the conservative side. And they said, well, we don't carry the liberals because there's no demand for it. And if there's a demand for it, we'll carry them. We'll have them on. So it's just one of those things where, depending on which side of an issue you're on, you magically see it differently. Now the hand of government is being sought to force Facebook and social media to carry things. But in terms of his question, I don't see it ever coming that way. It might move in that direction, but I don't see nationalization of Facebook and forcing them to allow people on their network that they choose not to. I really don't see that happening. I could be wrong, but I don't.
Yeah, I listened to an incredibly high-end podcast. It's called Stratechery. No, it's called, the podcast is called Exponent. The guy writes for a blog. It's called Stratechery. One of the things that he's super in favor of not deregulating not regulating them, and letting market, because at some point in time, Google appeared. You had a Microsoft, you had Yahoo. They were already in a place that they could have built the thing. But Google came out of nowhere and changed the world as we know it as far as internet search. Then Facebook takes over and no other social media platform goes. Twitter fits into its own niche. But then you have this new thing called TikTok. So like things can come up and take over. And I don't know that I've ever heard of anybody being banned from TikTok. And that's where people are migrating to. Now I hear, you know, then there was Parler, and now I hear maybe Trump is setting up his own social media network. There are places for people to go to do their social media gatherings. Just you can't necessarily do it there. And but there's a market driven reason for other ones to pop up that they don't necessarily need to be forced for our people to be allowed on their platform.
You made the point better than I could have in terms of broadcasting. There's only so much bandwidth. There's only so much spectrum available. When you look at your radio dial, there's only so many slots on there. And in terms of this, I don't know that we have those limitations. So I just don't see this happening. I know that our people are wishing for it, and I'm supposed to tell them what they want to hear, but I just don't see that happening. I really don't.
And Facebook is such a cesspool. But that is where 2 billion people, maybe be like close to 3 billion people per month use. And if that's where all of your family and friends post their stuff and you want to keep up with it, I think it's kind of shitty that our people can't be there under some level of scrutiny. I think that's kind of a crap move that just not everybody can go there, but that's, you know, I'm in favor of them. If that's what the rule want that they want it to be, then that's the rule that go take your way or somewhere else. I'm in favor of that.
Well, they really never wanted to be that way. They were pressured by government, and the government was responding to concerned parents who didn't think it was right for their little ones to be subject to all these predators roaming around on the social media sites. And so they stood tall for a while and said, no, we're gonna be available to everyone. But then they backed off because public pressure was enormous.
Which is so weird, because they are certainly willing to cave to anybody that wants to advertise and super hyper target to discriminate against people in housing markets and whatnot. I've heard some really diabolical stories about the advertising, the super micro targeting that you can do on Facebook, how you can determine almost down to a number of years. If you want like a 32-year-old, a 35-year-old, like you can get it hyper focused in this neighborhood, at least down to a zip code. You can super target market people. My understanding of the Trump campaign is they like, I don't want to say weaponized, but I mean, they put this on supercharge to hyper target market to people that were potential on the fence, whatever, how to get people to sway away from a candidate or towards a candidate. It's incredible what these very, very smart people have done to utilize the Facebook marketing platform. It's incredibly impressive what they do.
So, yeah, I don't see it being a public utility anytime soon.
All right. I'm with you. And then let me, you know, we'll do the voicemail from Mike in a little bit. But he reached out to me a handful of days ago, and he did his annual registration there in Florida. And he sent me this long text message describing out what had happened. And I think this is quite hilarious. He says, I had a very interesting conversation with the registry officer today. Basically, he tried to tell me that the registry was a civil regulatory scheme. I looked him dead in the eye and I said, are you going to stand there and tell me you don't think it's punitive? And I waited. He responded by saying quietly, well, honestly, man, you got railroaded and no one should ever have to register this long. He said, you got screwed like a lot of other guys. He went on to say that he believes very few guys who register are actually dangerous. He said he honestly thinks the whole entire thing is bullshit, but he still is, and I quote, just doing his job. I asked him, well, what if your job was hitting baby seals in the head with a board and killing them? He looked at me and said, I would never do that. So I asked him about the people who have been targeted and killed because they were on the registry. Then I asked about the ones who died locked up over civil violations. He just looked at me and he didn't have an answer. He really wasn't ready for me. Keep in mind, I've been seeing this guy for like 20 years. He knows me well and always talks with me. I like Mike a lot. He's pretty badass. And that's a pretty funny conversation to have with someone to say, well, I'm just doing my job. But suppose your job was doing something really horrific. Would you still go do your job?
Well, that's the question, though. He doesn't consider it that horrific. He's in his mind, he's treating people with respect and he's doing what they're telling him. And it's the law made by all the people. And he doesn't see it that way. Killing baby seals, I'm not sure that's a law that anybody would be able to cite to that's your job to kill baby seals. He's doing what the people in Florida told him to do. And they task his agency that he works for with doing that. So I don't know if I can make that comparison and do it with good conscience, because it really isn't.
But it's taking it to an incredibly extreme, because like you said, the law requires him to do the things, but he could go get another job, is I guess where Mike is going with that he's just doing his job, and potentially someone could have some sort of quote unquote civil regulatory violation of not registering. They put them in prison, and we've covered it halfway recently. Someone had something like that happen. They died while they were locked up for a civil violation. So I can see him making the parallel, but it is an extensive, it's a pretty deep jump.
Well, I mean, he's doing his job in his chosen career. And I mean, there are people who do give up jobs. We had a judge here, and his name is escaping me at the moment. He ultimately became Chief Justice of our state Supreme Court. When he was a district judge, he would not do. He decided to resign his judgeship because of mandatory sentences. He said, I'm not going to be a cash register. Okay. And so there are people who do that. But I don't think it's a reasonable expectation to tell someone that the law that's been made by all the people of Florida, that he should resign his job and put in 20 years and maybe jeopardize his retirement because he's doing something he finds a little bit distasteful. I don't think that's a reasonable expectation. Would you give up your job? There has to be things that you've been required to do through your life that you'd rather not do. I know I have.
Sure. Depending on the how extreme it goes, you could have some conscience issue with them asking you to do a thing and then you choose to resign. They were going to make a new search engine specifically targeted for people living in China, and they were going to restrict conversations of things like Tiananmen Square. If you try to do a search, Google was going to modify the search engine that if people in China did a search for Tiananmen Square, that it wouldn't return anything or it'd be filtered, whatever. And there were Google engineers that at least like walked out. I don't think they quit because they're probably very high paying jobs, but they at least tried to form some kind of collective to push back. And I don't know to what degree they did. I don't remember following it that closely, but people do sometimes take the moral high ground on something if they can.
They did. And the judge's name was Frank Keeney, and he did do that. He was not going to impose a sentence he didn't think was just, but that is the abnormal person.
Oh, definitely that.
There are people lining up, despite law enforcement's pretensions to the contrary. There are people who are lining up to be cops. There's pretty good job stability. There's pretty good pay and pretty good benefits. And I think we did maybe 50 episodes ago, or however it was, we talked about how many people were applying when law enforcement was trying to scare folks and say that this all this defund the police is causing us. And I think we ended up saying showing that there was like 2,000 applicants in some city in Texas for like 100 jobs. Yeah,
something
you remember
like
that episode? Yeah, so it's like it's like, so this job would not discontinue being done because this one person left the sheriff's department. They would just simply assign the task to someone else and it would continue to be done. The right thing to do is to try to change the law.
All right. Well, then we will move on from there. Let's do this little segment about the Interstate Compact piece, I think. Are you ready for that part?
I can get ready, sure.
I've been a subscriber to your newsletter for several years, and I appreciate all that you do. My question has to do with how I might get approved to live in another state so I can be released on parole. I'm in prison in Tennessee, and you people have convinced me that I should not live here if I can avoid doing so. The part you conveniently leave out is how the hell do we get the transfer process underway? I've resorted to writing to several states, and most do not answer. I've enclosed the responses I've received. What should I do next?
So, well, just out of curiosity, what were those responses that he received? What did they say?
Well, one of them says, this one looks like it came from Oregon, and says, this letter is in response to your letters and phone calls to our department regarding a possible compact. We require you to have a blood relative that is a resident of our state in order to be eligible for compact. Is this true, Larry?
That is nowhere in the compact.
Nothing says that you have to have some sort of biological relative in the receiving state to do transfer?
I am not aware of it, and I've studied that document with great intensity, and I'm not aware of any such provision in the Interstate Compact.
It says, if you're regarding parole to transfer to Tennessee and to California, state transfer request was forwarded to our office. For your information, all 50 states have provisions to supervise parolees from other states under the terms of the Interstate Compact for adult offender supervision. While you are in custody at a Tennessee correction facility, it is the responsibility of that facility to process the interstate transfer investigation request, or for more information, please log on to website listed for details on the transfer process. A state may permit a parolee to reside in that state while on parole if the offender is in substantial compliance with the terms of supervision, the offender is a current resident of receiving state and has family residing in the receiving state who are willing to have and the ability to assist the offender as specified in the plan of supervision from the sending state. And finally, offender can obtain employment and has documented financial means of support. But then they say they can't initiate the transfer investigation at the request of an inmate or family members. So they're telling them that they have to go through their institution there from their sending state to get that whole process underway.
That is correct. And we actually, this may be in response to the, I think it actually is in response to the February newsletter, Narsal Digest. We had a column in there of a person wanting to transfer and asking similar questions. And as I explained in that column, you can seek to have your supervision transferred through that formal process you just described. But what frustrates people is that the applications must be initiated by the authority. There's no initiation by you or your family. And I'm stressing that because you see it now on the letterhead from the Corrections Department in the state of California. Applications must be submitted by the state that's convicted you. They have the discretion to allow you to seek transfer if they choose. There are only some rare circumstances where they must permit you to leave. You have no right to be supervised in a state other than the one you were convicted in. That's the one right you do have after you've done your time, is you have the right to be supervised if you can remain violation-free, but you do not have a right to go to another state. It's a privilege. And in fact, many states impose an application fee. I think as high as $250 to submit an application to transfer. And this means it could be very expensive for you to request to be transferred. It's not a right. It's a privilege. And you've got to get your caseworker, if you're in prison, your integration, your reentry people, to help you initiate that process. If you do it, you will get the letters, if you get any response at all, just like the ones we read.
It's, you know, we've talked about this however many dozen times. How is it the process to transfer supervision and nobody really, like, it seems that nobody, including me, really completely understands. I know that you got to get your sending state, your current existing state to initiate the transfer. I got that part. But then all the conditions, like, it's complicated. What should a person do?
Oh, well, if you're a PFR, person forced to register, but we get asked about that regularly, those seeking transfer supervision should keep in mind that few states desire to supervise another state's PFRs for fear of potential liability should that person reoffend. I don't make that rule of life. I'm just telling you what it is. So you should attempt to find a proposed residence in the state you'd like to go to that would meet with their requirements. And then you ask me, well, how do you do that? And it's very difficult, particularly if you're behind bars. But there could be, your house could be too close to a school or a park, and you've got limitations of where you're allowed to live by law of the registration in the state you're going to. And then there may be no residency restrictions by law, and the supervising authorities may have their own policies that anybody who's subject to registration is not allowed to live within X number of feet of all these things. So simply researching the registration statute doesn't do it, because you may do come out very clean, say there's no residence restrictions in that state, and then your application is turned down because they say it's within 940 feet of a school and they have 1,000 feet requirement. So it's very difficult. It is very difficult. There's no one sitting there on the phone ready to talk to you, since they're actually hoping that you do not come. So it's very difficult. I wish I had answers.
Let's try and think about this like strategically for a minute. If someone were to want to transfer, should they take into consideration the state that they're going to and what kind of rules, regulations, restrictions, all those other words that we're going to throw in there to try and figure out where they want to go? For example, they want to go from an easier state and they want to go to Florida. Like, wouldn't you not want to go that way, and you would try and go from hard to easy and not from easy to hard?
Generally speaking, yes, you would not want to go to Florida if you were being released from a Vermont prison, because if you were being released from a Vermont prison, I can guarantee you that the registration requirements in Vermont are fair, are just much fairer and more reasonable than Florida. But you may have other issues in play, like you have nowhere to go in Vermont, and it's very cold and it's very expensive, and you really had no connections. You only came through for a weekend, and you got a conviction because you propositioned somebody who was underage and you didn't know it, and blah, blah, blah. You may end up in a position where you need to leave Vermont. Well, your support structure is in Florida. Well, then what do you do? Well, that's the whole problem. Guess what? Vermont's conditions go with you, whatever they imposed on you. Florida has the opportunity to add conditions, as long as they're conditions reasonably related to your offense and consistent with how they supervise people convicted of similar offenses in Florida. They can add additional conditions on your supervision that you did not have in Vermont. And they can, not only can, they will require you to register in compliance with their laws, because Vermont is no longer in control of your registration. So guess what? You get to lose Vermont's 10-year registration in a mail-in form in favor of a quarterly registration for a lifetime. You get to have a state that has no statutory restrictions in terms of where you can live, to go to a state that has a checkerboard of restrictions. If you're in Dade County, Miami area, 2,500 feet, 1,000 feet here, all these different restrictions, they're imposed throughout the state of Florida. And you have a much more hostile environment to live in. I mean, the climate might be better, but you went from a relatively rational place to a completely irrational place, and that's what would happen if you transferred from Vermont to Florida. But you may end up, that's your only choice.
I think you kind of mostly answered the next question that I have about which state controls. Was there anything you wanted to hone in on that one at all?
Well, it's confusing though, because people want to lump the registration and their sentence together, because they, in their mind, okay. they have decided that it's a part of the punishment, and it isn't.
Right. That is super confusing of the whole thing.
And the sooner you'll accept the fact that registration is not a part of your punishment, it is a collateral consequence that goes with your conviction, like certain occupational debarments that might go with it, your prohibition against owning a weapon Yeah, that's a collateral consequence. The obligation to participate in this regulatory scheme is a consequence. Therefore, the regulatory scheme that controls is the scheme in the state that you are living in. So you left Vermont's behind when you left that state. And when you went to Florida, you're now subject to Florida's registration requirements.
If we compare it to driving, which is a civil regulatory scheme, and you effed up like royally, you're driving 150 miles an hour and you're drunk, they're going to you will get punished for that aspect. But the regulation side is you may not get your driver's license back.
And that is a somewhat valid comparison, but the states have agreed to honor each other's suspensions. So if you're suspended or revoked in Vermont, Florida will not honor, will not give you a license. That was a racket that people used to do before computerization, as they would go get them another license. But nowadays, if you're under suspension or revocation in one state, you're not likely to be able to escape that by going to another state. They're going to tell you to get what's called a restoration of your driving privileges in the state where you're suspended or revoked, and then they'll issue you a license. But the rest of it is correct. If you went from a state where they had a free driver's license because you're over 75, and you go to Florida and you say, well, I got a free license in New Mexico while I was over 75, they would say, isn't that swell? Go back to New Mexico and they'll give you a free license there. But we don't do that here. Our requirements are that you pay the same thing everybody else does. And then if you argue with them, they'll say, well, you didn't have to come here.
Yeah, just go back home. Derek in chat asked about, he said he made the statement, he says, in doing this transfer, because he transferred from California to Texas, and he says that they take their sweet, precious time. My understanding is that they can't take their time. There are time limits on this.
That is correct. But what they'll do is they'll take the full 45 days.
Yep.
And then at the end of the 45 days, they'll notify them of a deficiency in the application packet. Because they were snowed under. So on the 43rd day, they'll say the packet was missing. There's a list of stuff that the packet's supposed to contain. And then when that trick runs out, then they'll tell them that the place is 939 feet from something, mm-hmm. and their restrictions are 1,000 feet. And you can go back and forth a lot with trying to be transferred because they do not want you to come.
And something we talked about pre-show is, if you were the registration office for your particular state, you would be like, I got this down to an assembly line process. I want to get rid of as many people as I can. I have no reason to deny anybody to leave.
Well, I say, but make sure that we emphasize the if, because people conveniently tune that out. they say that Larry said that he would like to get rid of as many. I'm saying if I were tasked with being in their role, if I had the responsibility of compact administration, and if I were going to be the one where the cameras came to my door asking me about offenders who messed up, the logical philosophy would be that you would want to get rid of as many as you can, because the more you get rid of, the more likelihood the cameras will roll in on another state's compact administrator rather than you. So that would be my philosophy. If I were in that position, I would want to get rid of as many as I could. There's nothing illogical about that at all. So I would not stand in any way. In fact, I would ask the legislature to repeal any transfer fees or in statute, and I would train our caseworkers to facilitate as many transfers as we possibly could.
Sure. I mean, that sounds totally reasonable. And then on the other side of that, if you were in charge of that office, you would probably try to figure out how to gum up any transfer coming in.
That's exactly what I would do. if I were training them on the other side of it, on the receiving end, I would say, look, we are going to follow the absolute requirements of the compact to a letter, but we're not going to give any additional flexibility. We're going to take the 45 days that we have, and we're going to reject where we can, as long as we're not blatantly violating the compact, and we're going to try to stem the flow of people coming to our state. That would be my philosophy if I were in that role, because the more I can keep out, the less likely the cameras are going to come in on me, and that would be my goal, because your career lasts a whole lot longer when you don't have problems when you're in government service.
I got you, man.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Okay, then let us move over to a letter that was sent over to Narsal about victims' rights. Is that okay to go there?
Sure. Yeah.
Cool. It says, "Dear Narsal, an area of the sex offender laws I have not seen addressed is the rights of the victims. Specifically, the right to remain silent and against cruel and unusual punishment. Under the Texas Family Code section, blah, 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 it states, and maybe I'll, Texas Family Code section 32.005A, except as provided by subsection C, a physician, dentist, or a psychologist having reasonable grounds to believe that a child's physical or mental condition has been adversely affected by abuse or neglect, may examine the child without the consent of the child, the child's parents, or other persons authorized to consent to treatment under this subchapter. Subsection B states an examination under this section may include x-rays, blood tests, photographs, and penetration of tissue necessary to accomplish those tests. When the victim states that they do not want to be examined, the attending physician under the statute is authorized to sedate the victim, place them on the examination table, and probe them. This is legalized rape and cruel and unusual punishment. Also, when the victim is interviewed and they state nothing happened or that they do not want to talk about it, they are then interrogated repeatedly for days until they say whatever the interrogator wants them to say. These are the same interrogation techniques that have been ruled illegal for law enforcement to use in criminal investigations. Yet, it's acceptable to use this against a minor. Given the victims, their constitutional rights would actually reduce the amount of people incarcerated for these crimes. They should automatically be appointed an attorney to protect their rights. These are the laws that should be addressed." Interesting points. God, I can see, Larry, I could totally split the fence on this one and go either way.
Well, I do like his concluding paragraph about a minor, but everything else in the letter is just totally off base. We have enormous power to require minors to do things. They do not have the full plethora of rights that adults have, and they can be examined against their will. There's a lot of things they can do. Now, normally there's a parent cooperating in this process. Normally you would never do anything like that. And I can only speak for my state, so I can't. Texas is a nation to itself in terms of how they do things, and this letter comes from Texas. But normally that wouldn't happen over the objections of a parent. But in terms of children, a child does not have the same rights. And the greater good of society is to determine if there has been a crime. And the only way we can determine that, since we cannot, children are not competent enough to be recognized as reliable witnesses, we need some way to determine if they have been a victim. And one way to do that is with a physical examination. So, you know, like I said, I like his closing paragraph, but in terms of examining a child, that's the normal way things are done.
And certainly, like, take the other side of this equation. There's a kid that is getting the crap beat out of it on a daily basis from an alcoholic parent. And the parent is being strategic in the way that they're beating the crap out of it. So there are no, like, visible bruises, but they're in places where clothing hides it easily. And something comes up and, like, hey, look, oh, crap, you have bruises all over yourself. Where did those come from? Oh, I fell down the stairs. Come on, man. When you fell down the stairs, you didn't knock every elbow and shoulder and hip and all that stuff for you to get all those bruises. There has to be some way for the state to then intervene and protect the child, even in an environment where the kid cannot safely speak out.
Correct. And I was responding to when the child's not the perpetrator, when the parents would be not the suspect, but in cases where the parent is the suspect, yes, the process is considerably different, because we're investigating the parent now. Wouldn't it be great if the parent could shut down the investigation against themselves? Wouldn't that be a fantastic system?
Yes, yes.
Very few parents that were abusing their children would consent to any examination, would they?
I'm confident of that one. Confident. So I think we're done there too.
Yeah, like I said, I think he's put a lot of energy into writing the letter, but I think he's not going to get any traction with those arguments, other than the fact that a child should have at some age an advocate to make sure that they're not being, that the whole process is not abusing them. So I did like that aspect of the letter.
Very good. And then if we head on over to the script that you prepared for the show notes. The first news story that you wanted to talk about was Congressman Matt Gaetz and the recent public disclosures about him. And I'm betting that you have a point, Larry, because I know how you are about these things. My understanding is that he sent a Venmo payment to another person that were to get him set up with younger women. They say that that one had just turned 18. How does that relate to our cause, Larry? What are you trying to bring up here?
Well, it relates because I continuously harbor about our cherished principle that a person is presumed innocent regardless of what the allegations are. And it hasn't been that many episodes ago that I've been pontificating about Governor Cuomo, who happens to be supposedly a liberal progressive Democrat. And I've said that he deserves that presumption. So now I want to show that I would say the exact same thing. It would be totally hypocritical for me if I said anything to the contrary. This instance of Congressman Gaetz, he's a conservative Republican who represents the first district, congressional district of Florida, which covers the Western Panhandle. And he deserves the exact same presumption. He deserves exactly what I said about the police officer and exactly what I said about Cuomo. No difference whatsoever. And the funny thing is that I'm not sure there's anything illegal about sending money on Venmo. The question is, of course, what was the money sent in exchange for? Was there a solicitation of anything that would constitute illegal conduct? And I'm not sure. I mean, that's what the investigation is going to show. But I would have a tidbit of advice for any Venmo user. Make certain that you set your transaction history to private. And then also there's a payment line, and it won't let you make a payment to someone without putting something in that payment line. And people put all sorts of jokes in there, anything from drugs to you name it, I've seen it. And make sure if you're going to put something in the payment line, it doesn't resemble illegal activity, because if you have that in the public feed and you say for the great whatever drug you name, you just might trigger an investigation of yourself. So be careful about what you say in public.
And I have a feeling that that would then be used in court to go, here they are admitting to what they're doing?
It very well could be. I'm not aware of any cases like that. But if you put that, you're buying drugs, which I've seen that several times on Venmo. If you put that as the reason for the payment, and then the person who received the payment is found to be selling drugs, and they point the finger at you and say that you're one of their customers, it would seem like that would be some evidence, at least as a prosecution might seek to introduce, because no one forced you to put that down.
Some people have been calling for him to resign, which I guess that would be the pattern, because whatchamadoo, he had to resign. What's the guy? The guy from Minnesota? The senator?
About the senator?
From, yeah, Frank. Al Franken?
Is that who you're talking about?
Yeah.
You're talking about Al Frank? Yeah, Al Franken.
Yes, I am. My internet just blipped for a second. But then how does that play out in the long way, on the long run?
Well, with Congressman Gaetz, I'm not sure. But based on Wikipedia, and you know, you can take that for what it's worth, he's engaged to be married. And I do know that this part of Florida, I know it very well, is very conservative. And it could be that he just can't withstand the public pressure, because if he's engaged to be married, and if there's substantial evidence that he's seeking romance from young women, it could be that his constituents are not going to be very supportive of that. That would be my expectation from that part of Florida. So I've also heard of the news that he's now retained legal counsel. So there may be something that develops out of this. If he felt the need to get legal counsel, it may be going somewhere.
Well, that would be as soon as you are contacted by law enforcement of anything, it seems like you should lawyer up, like, instantly. because you don't want to then potentially make matters worse, right?
Well, there are those who say if he hasn't done anything wrong, why does he need to lawyer up? You know, why does he need to be all lawyered up? There are people who say
because
that.
Because our system is garbage and you will get trapped in, like, it seems so easy. And now that the public is in it, like, his career is probably just about doomed just because the public is in on it.
Well, I'd say he needs to be lawyered up because whether or not you've done anything wrong or illegal is not the issue anymore. And I don't know that it ever has been. But the issue, as always, and I get a lot of eye rolling when people would come into office, that I would say the issue is not what you did.
Yeah.
The issue is what can they convict you of doing?
Yep.
And people say, well, how can they convict me of doing something I didn't do? And I say they do it all the time. Because of the way the law is written and the circumstantial evidence they have, they may be able to convict you of something you did not do. So we look at what can they convict you of as part of the analysis.
I mean, if we roll back to the thing just a minute ago about Venmo, let's just hypothetically work with me. If I send you $10 because you bought lunch and I say, hey, man, thanks for the great weed. And some investigator picks up on that and they go investigate. And that starts the process because I have admitted to using weed. So now there's some kind of investigation process, even though we just went to lunch.
Correct.
And I'm not saying I get convicted of anything, but that starts the scrutiny. Now you got the police coming by the house. Now the neighbors are talking and things, it just gets tense and stressful. And then maybe I have used weed and things just go out, all because we went to lunch and I made some kind of snide comment about thanks for the weed.
Yeah, there are people who more often than you would think put some sort of drug on there as the reason for the payment. And I've been playing with Venmo for the last 6 or 8 months, and I've seen so many things. I would never put that. I would never say that. But I don't think they give it a second thought. I don't think this highly sophisticated congressperson, who's quite young comparatively, in his 30s, I think 38 is what Wikipedia said. He grew up with this technology. Of all people, he should know not to be putting everything. Of course, maybe I'm just too conservative in terms of how I use. I won't even send an email, a critical email to someone. People start a thread and talking trash about someone, and they say, you never respond. I say, you will never see me talking trash about someone in an email. I'm just not going to do it.
Now that's on record, and I totally understand where you're coming from. And anything that you would post on anything of social media, including Venmo, including TikTok, it's very easy for someone to screen capture and build up a profile against you.
So, yeah, but I feel that the guy deserves due process. If he hasn't broken any law, he shouldn't have to step down from his office. I think that the people in the first congressional district of the Panhandle of Florida, they can decide in 2022 if he represents their values. But I'm tired of hearing of this. Everybody should resign for every little thing. You know, if he wants to have an affair, which this would be, if he's having a romantic engagement with a younger woman, that is an issue between him and his fiance. It does not involve his public service in any way.
All right. Shall we move on to the cert petition deal with May?
Let's do that.
Cool. And I understand that SCOTUS, the Supreme Court of the United States, has issued their one-line order denying the cert for Stephen May's case. You've harped on this for years now, Larry, and why are you so fixated on this thing? Because I'm tired of it. Just kidding. I'm not, because I like Stephen May, and I think this is garbage. But what has happened now?
Well, as we've talked about this a couple times recently, so I'm going to not spend gobs of time on it, but I think we were even on episode 169. But what we found, Narsal and I found so troubling, is that the Arizona burden of proof has been shifted to the accused. And that's becoming more common in American law. And it's just mind-boggling to me the hell that we can require the accused to prove anything. And people think, well, it only has to do with our type of offense. And that's just simply not true. It's just not true. The state of Florida has strict liability drug possession. You do not need to know that you're possessing a drug. You do not need to know it's in your car. You do not need to know that your teenage offspring put it in your car. If the cop pulls you over and the dog's alert on it, you're in possession. And Florida's a strict liability state. So the obsession people believe that Arizona's the only state doing, that's just not true. And that's what makes the issue, made the issue so important to us, is that we want the state to have to prove that you had a requisite criminal intent in your mind, that you knew that you had contraband in the case of Florida's drug statute, that you knew and intended to possess the drugs. And we want, in the case of Arizona's child molestation statute, we want you, when you're accused of child molestation in the state of Arizona, or in any state for that matter, for the state to have to prove that that touching was motivated by sexual interest, not that it was just simply a touching in the erogenous zones of a child or young adult. I think this applies all the way down to 16 in Arizona. But we want the state to have to prove that. I mean, what a concept.
Tell me, can you give me where strict liability is a valid way to have a law written?
Well, according to the Supreme Court, the strict liability offenses are very frowned upon, and there's no exact line, but it's in offenses where there are no significant life-altering consequences. And I think we would all agree of being convicted of a sexual offense is a life-altering. If you're speeding, there's generally not a life-altering consequence. You're going to get 3 points on your record, and you're going to have to pay some fees. And the fact of the matter is that we really don't care if you knew what the speed limit was. If you were texting on your phone and you missed the sign, that's really not our problem. The problem is that public safety was compromised because you were going 50 in a 25-mile-per-hour zone. And therefore, you're liable because you were speeding. And
so
you broke the law.
Strict liability is used for something inconsequential, minor kinds of things where, like you said, life-altering, but something just, it doesn't matter. You've left your library book checked out for too long, and eventually it becomes something significant. But nothing happens. You get your library card revoked.
That's correct. But in case of a serious felony offense where there are life-altering consequences, there should be no strict liability offenses. The state, the prosecution, should always have to prove that your mind was trying to break the law, that there was a requisite criminal knowledge and intent. A 70-year-old lady who happens to have some drugs on her person because her grandson forgot to take his dope to school when she gave him the ride, that does not make her a felon. Shouldn't make her a felon, but it could in Florida.
Okay. I was just going to say, so you and I go out to lunch and you get out of the car and you leave your whatever pills or dope bag, whatever, in my car. I'm toast because you left it in my car.
Well, you would be in the state of Florida.
Yeah. Do you have any sort of, like, how many states do, like, I don't know if that's even like the right kind of question to ask. How many states do this sort of thing? Are all states strict liability? I remember Catherine Carpenter talking about strict liability stuff. I'd never heard the term before until the first Atlanta conference. I had no recollection of at that before in my life.
There are strict liability offenses probably in most all the states. I know Michigan, that was the case of Zach Anderson, his journey to Indiana to hook up with a student resulted in a strict liability because she was underage and he didn't know it. And in the case of Michigan law, they did not care. It was a strict liability offense. And his family was having trouble comprehending that the issue was the strict liability. Zach would never have been into court if the prosecution had been required to prove that he traveled from Indiana to Michigan with the knowledge that he was going to be meeting up with a person who was underage. It just so happened that the person was underage, and Michigan takes the position that they don't care. So that was the issue, but he struggled with that, and he fixated on the fact that they didn't give him the Homes Useful Trainee Act relief, where he would have had to register. And of course you would want that if you had a conviction, of course you would want that. But the big boogeyman in the room was the strict liability. Zach would never have been in that position if Michigan had been required to prove anything, but they didn't have to. So Michigan certainly has that. Arkansas does. There are a number of states that have strict liability offenses that shouldn't be.
So what about like the reason why something that's non-sexual oriented, why would an adult be touching a minor's private parts?
Well, you might be doing it to save their life. If you were a lifeguard, in the case of what Stephen was, you might be doing it to grab onto whatever you could to get them to safety. I don't know all the details of the case because my issue was not the details. I'm not detail oriented when it comes to a particular person's offense. I'm on the grand cause, which is we need to require Arizona to prove if they're going to convict someone of child molestation that there was some criminal intent other than just touching a child's private parts. So I didn't fixate on all that, but that would be some reasons come to mind. Maybe when your coach congratulating slaps your butt, maybe that would be a situation. And I know people say that would never be prosecuted, but you know what? Things that you never think of prosecuted. If you've been listening to this podcast, we've talked about things that you thought would never be prosecuted because the police are overworked and the system is just so short-staffed. But yet we have case after case after case of things that you thought would never happen that did happen.
How about, is there anything else that Mr. May can do at this point, or is he out of options? And I heard that Maricopa County has created a prosecution integrity unit. Is that an option? Is there anything that you can do for a pardon or sentence commutation by Biden? Anything? Like, I'm thinking he's pretty much out of options.
Well, in terms of the last question, I'll take that first. Biden wouldn't have any authority because it's an Arizona conviction. So keep in mind, presidents can only pardon people for federal offenses. So this is not a federal offense. So there's nothing that Biden could do. But even if he could do anything, he wouldn't. Can you imagine what the right wingers would be saying if he turned loose a 75-year convicted sex offender and said, gee, I don't like that. Can you imagine what the... But this would fall to the governor of Arizona or whatever clemency processes they have in Arizona. But as you know, it's not likely for a person who has a sexual offense to get any type of executive clemency. And in terms of the prosecution integrity unit, that's also an extreme long shot. Even a career-minded prosecutor would be hesitant on that. But let's even talk about this particular prosecuting attorney. The Maricopa County Prosecuting Attorney's website has the bio of the prosecutor. And it says, quote, Adele began her legal career in Maricopa County Attorney's Office, where she was an award-winning litigator prosecuting felonies and advocating for victims' rights. During her more than 7 years as deputy district attorney, she served in vehicular homicide, crimes, gang, and drug enforcement bureaus. Does this sound like a person who wants to free a convicted PFR to you?
No, not at all.
So in addition, these types of special units need public support in order to secure funding for their existence. So if a person who had recently formed a prosecution integrity unit and they were trying to build public support for its ongoing existence, do you think that the general public would be supportive of freeing a person who had been convicted of molesting more than one child?
No, not even close.
So therefore, I know that I'm the bearer of bad news, but I do not believe that the prosecution integrity unit would actually even give this case any consideration. What they'll be interested in will be that they will try to find cases of actual innocence so they can parade around and say that due to the fact that we have diligently used the resources that you've entrusted us with, that we have discovered through our diligent and thorough investigation that there was evidence that this person should never have been convicted, that there was actual innocence of this individual, and we're putting a free person, we're making our wrong right. That's the type of thing that they would build public support doing, and therefore I think this is an extreme long shot that they would get involved.
All right, are we done with that? Move on.
Well, I guess I'll express a personal sadness that we gave it our best. He had the best legal team I have ever seen assembled working for him. I have no idea what his family's put out for him. He did the impossible. He wrote to us when he was fighting his habeas case, and I gave it such a limited chance that he could win in habeas court because of the rules of the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996, the law that limits federal courts from doing anything to relieve a person of a state conviction. And he did the impossible. He was able to have a U.S. district judge declare the Arizona child molestation statute unconstitutional. Then he lost that on appeal in the Ninth Circuit, which used to be a pretty liberal circuit, but under the four recent years of appointments, they've packed the courts with people who are not nearly as receptive. Like Stephen Reinhart was a good judge out there. He died. And he actually was one of my favorites in that circuit because he flooded the Supreme Court. And there used to be the joke about the Supreme Court's constantly overturning the liberal Ninth Circuit. And why do you keep ruling that way? And he says, well, one reason we do it is that they can't do them all. They can't review all of them. So we continue to do the right thing. And but people like Reinhart are hard to find now. And but this guy, he fought a great battle. Unfortunately, the courts did not want to hear his argument, including the Supreme Court. He's facing the remainder of a 75-year sentence. It's tragic, and I am really sorry. I'm really sorry. I mean, he's
and it's
a very
not like
neat
he's
guy.
2 years old, and he's going to get up when he's 77 years old. I mean, he's not a spring chicken. He's not old. I don't. Maybe he's 40. I don't know how old he is exactly, but I mean, this is, for all practical purposes, a life sentence, which is just shitty.
It is, and there are hundreds out there in Arizona prison. We receive letters from more than just Stephen. He was just the fortunate one who had the resources to do what he did, and the federal judge was so incensed about the statutory scheme when he declared it unconstitutional, he ordered him released immediately, and he has been out since 2017. Now he's got till May 17th to surrender back into custody. It's just a tragedy.
I hear you. Yep. All right. So here's a audio clip from Mike.
Hey guys, this is Mike down in Central Florida. Larry, Andy, just wanted to call in and say how much I appreciate you guys, and I missed you last week. I'm glad you got some time off, but I'm looking forward to the show. I wanted to make a statement about something I've heard Larry mention many times, and that's fiscal conservatives and why they would rather have folks locked up and instead of paying taxes and, you know, contributing. My tax bill this year was just shy of about $18,000. With that said, I did make some really good money. I understand a lot of people haven't been in that situation, and I've been very blessed. I work very hard for what I have. But with that said, it makes no sense to me why our state legislator would continually work to take someone like me and make it harder and harder to maneuver the registry laws in the state of Florida, even though my charges are close to three decades old and no reoffenses, none of that. But that's an even issue. Just it doesn't seem like they really care if you contribute, if you re-assimilate back into the community. And it seems like the end game is just getting that pound of flesh and that hate, and they can't appear soft on any kind of sex crime of any kind, as no matter whether it costs a fortune and makes no financial sense at all. And I think I can bear witness to that. Hopefully I didn't mumble through that and it was clear enough. I really appreciate you guys. I'm looking forward to the show, and FYP to anybody who doesn't like the Registry Matters podcast.
I think at the end there, he either got a text call, like a text message, or maybe a truck drove by and tooted the horn. But thanks always, Mike. It is a pleasure to have you support the show and to talk to you when we do on the text message stuff.
And I agree with that. I want to thank Mike for his longtime support. I think he's one of our original patrons.
Very much so.
Second, I want to drift a bit from his actual point because I have to pontificate. I'm wondering if he was including the amount of what he pays in taxes, if he's including Social Security and Medicare in that $18,000. Since Florida doesn't have any personal income tax, I'm assuming that he's referring only to his federal tax assessments. And some try to have it both ways in terms of Social Security. They include that as a part of their total tax burden, and then they turn around and assert that it's their personal retirement fund. And it's not your personal retirement fund or your personal retirement account. It's an assessment that insures workers and eligible family members and dependents. That's what it is. Now back to the point that Mike is trying to make. this is actually an opportunity or maybe an opening for him to influence the legislative process in Florida. It's quite conceivable that no one has ever presented that argument about the importance of paying taxes to support government. And I would urge him to determine who his state legislators are and reach out to both his senator and his representative and have that discussion with them about that it's in our societal greater interest to have people who've been convicted of all offenses, and even including sexual offenses, to have them working and paying taxes and not on any type of system, and tell them, see, a conservative, that would really appeal to them because they don't want to increase taxes because it's so dreadful to have the, even a discussion about taxes, and say, look, the more people we have putting into our systems of revenue streams, the better off we are, and the more you can keep taxes low. And I know how dedicated you are to keeping taxes really low.
Yeah. So how about making that communication flow easier? Does he just go, hi, I'm Mike, I'm a constituent, and this sucks. Can we have lunch? I mean, like, what do you do?
I would recommend that he do some research by checking out the bios of his senator and representative and find out as much as possible he can about their achievements and what their committee assignments are. And then you need to initiate an opening short communication thanking him or her for their work on the issues that they've worked on. And I don't care what the issues are. Very few lawmakers don't have something that they work on, and thank them for that work. And then request a short constituent meeting, and they are more than likely going to agree to meet with you and request a short meeting to talk about criminal justice without being too specific. You do not want to tell them that you want to do anything good to help people required to register, but just tell them that, you know, that you realize that Florida has a very expensive criminal justice system, and you've got some ideas that you think you would benefit to have a short conversation, and stay true to your word. Intend to go in with a short conversation. And you might be surprised that they respond. Provide a phone number, an old-fashioned phone number in your communication, and plan to answer that phone. Because I absolutely promise you that they prefer to talk to you by phone rather than trying to have a series of digital exchanges that might come back to bite them in the you-know-what later. So if you provide a phone number, please answer the phone.
And I know you said don't get into specifics, but here is, you're asking something of a legislator to initiate some sort of bill that's going to help PFRs. Is Florida a year-round state? I'm going to guess that they are because of their size.
No, they're not.
Oh, but they're not either. Oh my God.
But no, you're not going to have to get specific. You're not going with a bill in mind. You're going in mind with, by the time you get to see them, you already know what their priorities are. So you're going to go in knowing a little bit about them, and you're going to say, I know that you're committed to fiscal responsibility, because I can just about guarantee you that based on Mike's income level, he's probably living in a place where it tends to be politically conservative. And people, the more income they have, the more they all of a sudden don't think that they should pay taxes. And I'm not picking at him particularly. I'm just saying that that's just the tendency of people. The more they have, the more they see like, well, the government's trying to take everything that I make. And so I suspect that he's going to have conservative senator and representative. And he's going to know that that person is dedicated to keeping the cost of government, particularly corrections. There's no public support for spending a lot of money on corrections. So if you tell him you have some ideas, him or her, some ideas about making government more efficient in terms of criminal justice system, and you just want to talk about the broad issue of criminal justice, you don't have a particular wish list. You're going to get to know your senator or your representative. That's all you're going to do on this initiative. But I say the importance of forming relationships, this is step one.
Sure.
Of forming a relationship. And that's what I would recommend. And when you're making that pitch, those are your important points. Madam Representative, we've got to have all these people out working and paying taxes so that you don't have to raise taxes and look for new revenue streams. We need, the government has so many responsibilities that we need to raise revenue so that we're not doing budget cuts on critical things that you support. I mean, you've got to talk their language.
And he's not going in there and saying, hi, I'm Mike, I'm a PFR for 30 years. He's saying that here's a situation that could be addressed. Just these people are riddled with all this extra baggage, and it would help if they didn't have all this baggage. That's the end of that conversation?
That's the end of that conversation. And that representative will either turn their nose up and turn their chair around backwards, or they'll say, you know, you make some good points. Let's keep the dialogue going. And then the next part of the dialogue is you're a little bit more specific about what you'd like to see. They're not going to be able to abolish the registry, nor are they even going to consider that. But they might start taking down some of the barriers that make it so difficult for people to reenter society, which would be a major victory. And you can promise him, so I can promise you this, that no Democrat is going to vilify you for being reform-minded on criminal justice. Now, they'll vilify you for other things, but on this one, if you take any vilification, it'll be from a Republican. I'm assuming that, again, I'm jumping to conclusions that he may be represented by. Florida's a very Republican state. When you get outside of Tampa, when you get outside of Miami, you have an awful lot of Republican domination in Florida. So I don't know that I could be totally wrong, but tell if it turns out that his senator and representative are Republican, so I can promise you won't get vilified by the Democrat Party on this.
Yeah, so. I hear you. Okay. We're running super long. So we can wrap up the shop if you are done. I think you are.
I am.
I just want to make sure that we acknowledge we got a couple new patrons and then one that I forgot to mention, but Dakota, thank you so much. You are a new patron and so very much appreciate your support. And then a mega thanks goes out to Dustan for his fantastic level of support. And then also a couple weeks ago, Justin he's like the contributor, the supporter of all time for the podcast. He wins. If anyone wants to try and catch up to Justin, I wish you the best of luck. And he also then increased his support. He did that a few weeks ago, but I forgot to mention it. And thank you, Justin, for your long time and incredibly generous support. Larry, anything else before we go?
Let's get out of here.
Cool. Go find everything over at registrymatters.co. You can find phone numbers, all that other stuff over there. With that, Larry, I hope you have an incredibly wonderful evening and the rest of your weekend, and I will talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me back this week.
Always. Take care, bye, friend. Bye.
You've been listening to FYP.